your name.
Good timing.
Senator Starr is not absent, he's excused today. And Senator Farioli, likewise, had some other commitments. So we'll start, now that we have a quorum, the Judiciary Committee has a quorum, and start with Senate Bill 302, public hearing. Gina Skinner, is that right?
That's right. And Josh.
And Josh.
Marquis. Do you guys want to come up?
Gina and Josh. The Gina and Josh show.
And Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 302 relates to DUII diversion. In Oregon, people are eligible for DUII diversion on their first time offense if there was no physical injury in the occurrence. And however, to get into DUII diversion, there's no plea of guilty. You do a petition within 30 days currently, and then if you make it through diversion, there's no conviction. And on your driving printout, it would just show that you had a diverted case. If you fail diversion currently, you then have the opportunity to go to trial. My reading of this bill is that you would have to get into DUI diversion now under this bill, you would have to plead guilty, and then that plea would not be entered as a conviction by the judge. And so then if you failed diversion, you couldn't go to trial, and it would that would settle the matter. They would enter the conviction.
All right. Who's going to go first? Josh? Go for it, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Josh Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County. I'm the former president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association, on whose behalf I'm speaking today. I also used to serve on the governor's DUII committee, and I'm Oregon's representative to the National DAs Association. I mentioned that last one only because in preparation for this hearing, I sent out an email to my colleagues around the United States asking what other states do. Actually, Representative Prozanski had sent an email to the DAs Association saying, what do other states do? And it appears in about 80% of those states that have DUI diversions, and a number of states flat out don't allow diversions in DUIs. But those that do absolutely require guilty pleas. And you have a letter from Jerome Cooper, who is both the chair of the governor's DUII committee and a circuit judge pro tem in Multnomah County, who presides over the DUII diversion court. And I think that letter will give you some real interesting and important historical perspective about what was intended with DUII. And let me very briefly explain what this bill attempts to do, and it has, I think, some really major financial benefits. The whole idea of DUII is that the first time, at least the first time in 10 years that somebody gets a DUII, if they make an early recognition they've got a problem, they go through treatment, we're not going to stigmatize them with a conviction. And this doesn't seek to change that part of it. If they go into the program and they do it, fine. The problem has been that if they go into the program and they fail, that there's no entry of a guilty plea. There's simply a trial. And what's happening in the counties like mine and many others around the state is there's a pretty significant group of people, probably between around 40, sometimes 50%, who don't do well in diversion and end up 6, 8, 12, 18 months later. Then you try to find the police officers, pull the case together. So if a guilty plea was a precondition of a diversion, we'd be cutting down enormously on court time, on police overtime, which Chairman Minnis, I'm sure, can speak to probably far better than I can, prosecutor time, and basically resolve these cases and close them out a lot earlier. Again, a person who complies with the diversion would still get all the benefits they do currently. The other two parts of the bill are designed to sort of interface with that. Ann Christian is here, and I haven't had a chance to get the numbers together, so I can't tell you precisely. It would be my guess that we would be saving hundreds of thousands of dollars, however, a year, because it's different counties have different policies about appointing DUII lawyers for diversions. In my county, it's fairly common. In Multnomah County, it's fairly common. The theory is that, look, the person needs to know what the consequences of going into a diversion or not are. So the second part of this three-part bill would say, if you're given a court-appointed attorney, and that's fine because DUI does have some serious consequences down the line, that you're required to repay the cost of it. we're talking about, and again, Ms. Christian can tell you most of the time, $290 or $300. I mean, if you go out and retain a lawyer for DUI, I guarantee you it ain't going to cost you $300. The state of Oregon is giving people a pretty good deal by that. The other thing that's significant about that is that as a group of a class of individuals, people charged with DUI, which is probably one of our most democratic offenses in the sense it's committed by people of all income levels, all social strata, are probably the most people who are going to be the most likely able to repay that money. And although we didn't speak about this at ODA, Ann and I talked about it, and it makes sense to me that those repayments, rather than going into the general fund, should probably go back to the Indigent Defense Fund because the repayments for indigent defense, and it would help what we all know is a serious deficit that indigent defense has and probably will continue to have. The third part of the bill has to do with a provision that allows a judge currently to extend the period for good cause. Now, in most of Oregon, I found out, because I also polled all the counties, this is not a problem, to be honest with you. But in Marion County and Clatsop County and at least three or four other counties, judges have taken the position that any time a defendant wants to file a motion to suppress or challenge the legality of the stop, that's good cause. So here's what happens. Somebody gets arrested on a DUI. They blow a .19 or something really high. It's a loser DUI, but the defense attorney, particularly if they're retained, but also if they're appointed, goes, you know, I'm going to take a shot at a motion to suppress. I got a 20% chance of winning. Maybe the officer won't show up. Or in my case, maybe the trooper will be laid off and he won't show up. So we re-litigate this. We win probably 80 to 90% of these motions to suppress. But then these cases are now 8, 9, 10, 12, 18 months old. And what's happening now is they're being allowed into diversion. And as the letter from Judge Cooper makes clear, that was never the intention. The intention was that it be 30 days. So you'll see that what we have proposed is extending that 30 days to 60 days. Because in fairness, for example, my county's pretty typical. You might have somebody who's a fisherman, and he gets busted for DUI, and he has to go out on a fishing trip. And maybe he can't make that 30 days exactly. So he's up in the Bering Sea, comes back 45 days later. Should he be denied the opportunity? No. Now, currently it says that the judge can find good cause. Now, this may be one of the more controversial parts of it, but we're saying take out that and say that except on acceptance by the district attorney, it can't go beyond 60 days. In my county, if a lawyer comes to me and says, hey, look, this guy was, in the Army, or he was in the hospital for 3 months, will you grant a diversion? My deputies routinely do. That's not a problem. But we are litigating lots and lots of DUI cases that I don't think were ever intended to be litigated. The overall effect of this bill will be to save an enormous amount of court time, a significant amount of indigent defense money, a lot of police overtime, and a lot of resources in district attorney's offices that are being spent. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
Okay.
I've personally tried about 300 or 400 DUI cases, so I'm pretty familiar with the subject.
Right. Senator Burdick, then Senator Ingo, and then Senator Walker.
You said that 80% of the states that you checked with had the requirement for a guilty plea.
Of those that had diversion.
Yeah, how many states was that?
I got about 12 or 15. I got about 35 responses from different states. Okay. Of those states, about 35% didn't have a diversion. Of the ones that responded, about 80% of those. So it was about 15, I think, or 16 states said we require guilty pleas or the functional equivalent of guilty pleas. For example, Massachusetts requires that the person stipulate to the police report. So basically it would be a stipulated facts trial.
Okay. And the other thing is, maybe I'm just slow this morning, but I didn't understand what you're getting at with the 60 days. Could you just go through that
I'm sorry.
Quickly again?
I probably didn't make it clear. I apologize, Senator Burdick. Currently, there's a 30-day deadline to enter into diversion. The theory is from the date of the summons, you've got 30 days, and the theory is, okay, get your head together, go talk to a lawyer, and decide whether you're going to go into the diversion program. Current law allows that to be extended for good cause. The problem is that in a number of counties, good cause means anything. So basically, the fact that the lawyer wants to litigate the case out is determined to be good cause. Now, on the other hand, my understanding is in Multnomah County and Wayne County and other places, the judge are saying absolutely not. So we're getting different things in different places. And that's why I'm saying, suggesting we take it from 30 days to 60 days. That would really give somebody an opportunity to talk to a lawyer. But then say after that, it's we're not really going to allow you, because that was the original intention, was to make people make a decision relatively soon which path they were going to go down, the diversion path or litigating the case path.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. Hi. What's your thinking on the agreement the defendant to pay attorney fees?
We require the defendant at this point to, it would be consistent with if we're requesting that people plead guilty and we're giving them the benefit of the privilege of a diversion and the relatively low cost that indigent defense is placing on that, that it doesn't seem unfair to ask that defendant in either case, whether they benefit from the program by getting the diversion, that in addition to the diversion costs, which I believe are substantially less than the cost of being found guilty, that they pay the $290 to $300. And no. Certainly if they flunk, so to speak, if they're found guilty, because current law clearly already allows judges to impose, in fact, judges routinely impose court-appointed attorney's fees as a consequence of a guilty plea or a guilty finding by a jury.
Okay. Explain that a little bit more. Defendants are entitled to a court-appointed defense, correct?
Right. If there's some question whether they're in diversion, but many judges, they do get it, yes.
All right. Some would be able to afford to pay for their own defense, obviously, but
right.
Some won't. The ones that get a court-appointed lawyer, isn't it fair some of them won't even be able to pay the costs to the court for that?
Well, it's the same problem we have with any kind of court-appointed. The law, as I understand it, is the court cannot make someone pay anything if they simply don't have the capacity to pay.
Let me interject. The amended language in the bill says an agreement by the defendant to pay attorney's fees as determined by the court. So I'm assuming the as determined by the court allows fairly broad discretion.
You get a transient or someone with absolutely no money, it's not reasonable to expect that person to pay the $290. But as a class of people, I can guarantee you the DUI defendant is probably 4 to 5 times more likely than any other defendant are going to be able to pay that.
Well, I'm sure. I'm going to bet you most DUI defendants hire their own lawyer. I bet a lot of them do.
Oh, a number, yeah.
A second ago, you said that the court already has the authority to require the defendant to pay the defense costs.
Upon a guilty finding, yes.
I see. But not upon...
It's certainly not clear that a diversion that doesn't result in a guilty verdict, I don't think it's clear that the court has any authority to order somebody in the event that they're not convicted to pay.
Well, if we make the first change you're requesting, though, so that the plea of guilty does occur, then doesn't that give the court the authority to allow for attorney fees?
It certainly would in those cases where the person flunked out. I'm proposing to go one step farther and saying for even those people who successfully complete diversion that it's not unreasonable to ask them, assuming they can afford it, to bear the cost of what indigent defense is paying and steer that money back to the indigent defense fund.
And the court has the discretion to determine whether they can afford it or not.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought the people were already required to pay for the cost of diversion.
They pay a cost for the diversion program. There's a fee for going into diversion. I think it's about $300, and then they usually have to bear the cost of the treatment. There are definitely already costs for going through diversion, and the idea is that you're going to basically, I wouldn't say a free DUII, but you're not going to have the DUII go on your record. Yes, you pay a fee to the court, an administrative fee. You generally pay for your expenses. This would be an additional amount, assuming that the judge found that they were able to pay, that they would have to pay on top of that.
Okay. Then I would let you know that my opinion about that is they should only have to pay that if they fail the program. I'll just tell you that's my opinion. Secondly, I'm very concerned about giving the DA even more power than they already have. Today, DAs have a lot of power, and we met with the Supreme Court yesterday for lunch, and we talked about the problems that we have in the court system not having enough money, and the DAs are going to have to be choosy about which cases they prosecute because there won't be any money to hear them in court. My concern is your change to allow the district attorney to consent to the extension of time. Why is it that you think they should have that power rather than the court?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, it is true that in Oregon and in every state, the district attorney has considerable discretion. DUII is not a right, it's a privilege. And the problem that exists, frankly, in some counties is that some judges are just saying, you know, we don't care that it says 30 days. We're basically going to let people litigate this out. The only way I can think of to be fair, which is to grant an escape hatch for those people that really do have a legitimate claim, such as, you know, my mother died or, you know, I was off on a fishing trip, versus what I'm experiencing in my county where the judges are saying, well, I think they have a right to litigate it. And that's a real fundamental difference of opinion. I mean, if we're going to allow people to essentially litigate DUIIs and then give them diversions, that's not really a diversion. That's a free DUII.
Okay.
I think you have to vest some amount of faith in the prosecutors in the same way that, and I'm not trying to drag Measure 11 into this, but in 1994 we estimated that there would be 6,000 people in prison for Measure 11 because of the projections at the time. In 2000, and in 2000 there were about 3,000 people, and the reason for that was the discretion exercised by district attorneys. We work very closely with our local judges. We appear in front of them every day. If we start getting unreasonable, believe me, they have ways of jerking our choke chain real fast.
Well, I understand that, but you did get a lot of power when Measure 11 went into effect, and you continue to gain in the power that you have, sometimes more so than the court, and this seems to extend even more to district attorneys. Let me ask you this. Is there another showing besides a showing of good cause for the court? Is there a higher standard required? Is it just good cause?
No.
Okay.
That language is used in other places, Senator Walker, and basically it basically just gives discretion of the court if they choose to do it.
Okay. My third and final question then is, we all talk about diversion. I've never experienced it. I don't practice in state court, so I don't see that. So could you please give me a little refresher about what diversion is and how long the course is and what they are required to do?
Well, generally, if a person has not participated in had a DUII for 10 years in this or any other state or participated in a similar treatment program like a drug court, they have the opportunity, theoretically, within 30 days of the summons, to enter into a diversion program.
This bill would change that to 60, right?
Yes, this would extend that time out to 60.
Okay.
Generally speaking, they have to pay an administrative fee, which I think is around $300, and then depending on what the resources in that county are, they have to go through some form of alcohol education and treatment program. Many times it's a two-level program where first the evaluator decides how bad that person's alcohol problem is. It may well be that all they need basically to do is to be told, you know, educated about, you know, don't drink and drive, this is really bad, it can hurt people. Or you might have somebody who really is an alcoholic and needs to be steered into a 12-step program or something else. Once they've completed that program,
takes how long?
12 months.
12 months?
In 12 months, they've completed the program and they've not gotten arrested for another DUII, and this law doesn't change that part of it, then that comes off their record as a conviction and it's a diversion. And they can say that they have not been convicted of the crime.
Okay. And after they complete diversion and they get it off their record and lo and behold, they are found driving drunk again, which is not uncommon, then they're not eligible for another diversion?
For 10 years. They are not eligible for another diversion.
Okay. All right, thank you. That answers my questions.
Right. Any other questions?
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
Her question raised another question in my mind. Who determines whether it's been successful or is a failure?
generally the treatment provider. I mean, again, we vest in them. They're the ones who report back to the court and say, this person's been compliant. Some of them, for example, will allow somebody to maybe miss a meeting or two, but if essentially if it's in the treatment provider's opinion that they have done what they're supposed to do, they've paid their fines, and assuming, again, they haven't gotten busted again for DOII, we generally leave that with essentially the social service professionals who provide that service.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I had another question in another area. When you're talking about the problem with the 30, with the extensions from the 30 days, you say that they litigate and then go into diversion, and that amounts to a free DUII. How does that work exactly?
Well, I'll give you a really vivid example. I'm currently prosecuting a case where a guy got a DUII in April of 2002. And then another DUII in May of 2002. And it was diversion eligible on the first one. But because my courts don't require him to do it within 30 days, he litigated, and it's taken us 8 months to litigate that first one. We're not even at the trial stage yet. He also then is litigating the second one, which we also won that motion to suppress. But in neither case has he come to trial yet, and it's been better part of a year.
By litigate, you mean motion to suppress.
A week ago,
suppress the breathalyzer
or the stop. And in both of these cases, like in typically, we've litigated the motions in the state one. A week ago, this young man, whose driver's license has not yet been suspended, has not been under the court process, blew a .28 and ran through an intersection and killed a 73-year-old lady. This is somebody who, if presumably he had been forced to go into a diversion program, at least would have not had a license and certainly would have been under some sort of treatment. It's a dramatic example, but it was one that was really brought home to me when I was talking to the family of this victim.
Okay. Any other questions? There are none. Gina, you've been very patient. Do you have additional things to say?
I just have one brief comment to make. Again, Gina Skinner. I'm a deputy district attorney. I've been in both Marion and Washington. I'm currently in Washington County. I just want to point out again for, because I obviously assume that only Craig Prince is the one that really has litigated DUIIs on the panel, that this is the most commonly litigated crime. I don't have the exact percentage, but I'd be willing to bet that by far, I don't have a number, but by far, if you picked out one statute and you look on the trial docket every day in Washington County, there's probably anywhere from 2 to 6 of these going to trial every day. This is an extremely common case, and we spend an inordinate amount of time, not only with the prosecutor's time, but the court costs and the criminal defense costs. One of the advantages here with the change in the bill is that it's still giving the opportunity to the people that are eligible for diversion will still get this off their record if they complete the treatment. It also gives them an extra incentive because I think a lot of people enter diversion with sort of this attitude, well, if I fail it, you know, I'm just back to where I was a few months ago. It's like they didn't really lose anything because they're back to square one. And so they're kind of like, well, I kind of, you know, pussyfooted around with this for 6 months. I didn't really like treatment, so I'll just go back to square one, and maybe the state will lose their case. This way, it gives them a huge incentive, knowing that guilty plea is over their head, that if they complete successfully, that they will, in fact, get dismissed, and I think they'll try harder to do the treatment. And if they do get it off the record and they complete it successfully, that's great. That's what we're trying to do. The other point I just want to bring out is Mr. Marquis talked about the problems with dragging out some of these cases, but what I've seen in my personal experience is the people that fail to appear. I would be willing to bet anywhere at least 30% of these people that commit these crimes, they enter diversion, again, don't have a great attitude about completing the program, and knowing that they haven't completed it successfully, they just take off. They just don't ever come back to court, whether they go to another country, they go to another state, or they just don't come to court and stay at home. Then there's just all that happens is a warrant is issued for their arrest. Well, that warrant can be out for months or years. And I've personally tried cases that are 3, 4, 5 years old where people, the police officers are not at your agency anymore. They're not even, I had one where there's not even a police officer anymore. He was a civilian. He no longer was a police officer. You've got civilian witnesses, maybe the only one that saw the person driving called it on their cell phone, and by the time the police officer was involved, the only person that saw the driving was a civilian, and that civilian has long moved, and you're unable to find that person. The police are required then to pay to be paid for that time to come into court when they're either a civilian now or they are at another agency. All the overtime of police coming in to testify, and then the agencies are required to retain all that evidence for these years and years and years while the person is out, and yet we're having to go back. We can't explain to a jury why this has taken so long, and we're now presenting a case that happened in 1996 or 1997, and just like it happened yesterday, with no explanation, hoping that they're still going to look at the person and hold them accountable and not put that against us like it's our fault. But for those people, they're given a huge advantage, and quite frankly, they're just hoping that we'll all forget and it will just go away. And if they do drive legally under the influence in Oregon, we want to be able to hold them accountable, and we think that this bill, in fact, we'll do that.
All right. Other questions? No other questions? No other comments? We got Ms. Sugar. Kamala Sugar. Am I pronouncing it right? If not,
Kamala Sugar. The ODAA chairman and members.
I should have brought you up with the rest of the folks.
Well, and I really don't have too much more to add to what they said. I was thinking of two things, though, that might address some of the questions. One was that we could provide you with a copy, Senator Walker, of the diversion petition, and it would spell out a little, I mean, just for your information, would spell out some of the conditions of a diversion and what might happen and what the judge looks at and the things that the person has to sign and agree to. So we'll see if we can get a copy for you. And then the other point I thought of making was if the committee is uncomfortable with this language regarding the district attorney consenting to an extension of time, I suppose the other way to address the issue would be to not make this available after the defendant has filed a motion to suppress or controvert, and to make it just to limit the court's discretion in that regard. And I think your committee counsel might be able to speak to that more clearly or suggest some alternative language. But, I mean, that's truly what we're trying to avoid, are these the expense of litigating those motions. So that's all I had to add.
Actually, I think that's a good suggestion. I think Mr. Prince whispered something like that in my ear a few minutes ago. So, because I was sitting here toiling with the idea of having an absolute deadline. Of 120 days or something of that nature. But, okay, good suggestion. Thank you. And now Susan Russell, it's your turn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'm here in opposition of Senate Bill 302 to present an alternative perspective and some additional information as well. In our opinion, Senate Bill 302 is an unnecessary and costly bill. Senate Bill 302, by requiring a guilty plea before a defendant can enter diversion, would mandate the appointment of counsel in all DUII cases where the defendant is indigent. At present, appointment of counsel is not constitutionally mandated in DUI diversion programs. Even if the court, at the end of the case, orders repayment, indigent defendants do not always repay. The cost of diversion, I think it's fair to say, can be significant for an indigent defendant. There is there's a fee to enter the program. What was being proposed this session, that fee be increased. There is the cost of treatment itself. As inexpensive treatment providers are being forced to close, it's my anticipation that cost is only going to increase. Where individuals successfully complete a diversion program, I believe that Senator Walker's sort of view may be also found or reflected in the judiciary, and that courts will be unwilling to require that court-appointed attorneys fees be reimbursed, and the court would have discretion and has discretion. In terms of the time frame of increasing the time frame from 30 days to 60 days, I think one of the things the court needs, or that this committee needs to be clear, is that we're really changing the whole practice of DUI diversion. By requiring appointment of counsel in all cases, there is an obligation on the attorney to investigate the case for trial and to potentially prepare for trial. 60 days may be an adequate time to determine whether or not someone may benefit from a DUI diversion. It is not an adequate time in terms of being able to assess the case. Defense attorneys have an ethical obligation to investigate a case. Failure to investigate could result in post-conviction relief and the conviction being set aside. These cases, I think it's fair, I would agree with the representation that's been made previously that these are highly litigated area of criminal practice. There is a specialized caseload. It's probably the most intensive motion practice. And there are a number of factual matters that may need to be investigated. There may be blood or urine analysis. There may be disputes as to whether or not a breathalyzer was adequately maintained. There may be records that need to be obtained in terms of the maintenance of a breathalyzer. These are standard matters that take place in the investigation of a DUI case for trial. There may be no breath test. It may be simply a question of the officer's observations and tests that were conducted by the officer. They may be in dispute. There may be independent witnesses in the car or, let's say, at a tavern or a residence where the defendant has consumed alcohol. It's usually not the case the defendant denies consumption of alcohol, but there's a dispute as to how much alcohol was consumed. Often experts are called in terms of the drug and alcohol analysis. So it's a very specialized area of law, and it's simply impossible in a 60-day period of time where an attorney is appointed to review the merits of the case and the DUI diversion to require an attorney or to expect an attorney could actually do that and fulfill his or her ethical obligations to thoroughly investigate the case. In addition, this proposed amendment would allow the DA to determine under all circumstances whether an extension of time is allowed and would take away the court's discretion. So you're kind of putting the DA in a situation where the defense attorney's argument for an extension may be that they've had inadequate time to prepare the case for trial, to have a district attorney being able to decide whether or not a defense attorney should have opportunities to prepare a case for trial. So you're sort of putting them they have a benefit, should I say, the district attorney for opposing any extension. There are alternatives. If one of the complaints is the time in which an individual is allowed to determine or to reflect on whether or not it's in his best interest or her best interest to enter diversion. There were some discussions about pretrial motions. I know in Multnomah County, for the most part, pretrial motions are not allowed. It may differ from county to county. I think the committee, if the concern really is the time frame that extensions are allowed to litigate the case presently, then I think that the appropriate response would simply to be to say, as a condition of diversion, there's a prohibition on pretrial motions to say that rather than requiring a guilty plea, that simply you have a period of time. And I wouldn't say that 60 days is, there are often circumstances that will require 60 days. I would approve of an extension to 60 days with the court to be allowed the determination of whether good cause exists for an additional extension, but simply to provide that pretrial motions cannot be filed as a condition of entering diversion program. I believe that Senate Bill 302 would increase the number of DUI trials. Defendants may be unwilling to plead guilty in order to enter diversion. I believe there'll be an incredible increase in court costs if the cases go to trial, because I think, as one of the district attorneys represented, these are very expensive cases with a huge amount of pretrial practice as well as the trial itself. Defendants under this bill, defendants who are not guilty, would become ineligible for diversion. Because it requires a guilty plea. A not guilty defendant may choose to enter diversion for a number of reasons at present. May not want to risk, he or she risk the outcome of a trial, may not be able to afford an attorney or the cost of a trial, or the defendant may simply want treatment. I do not believe that there is a need for Senate Bill 302. Current law already provides that a defendant in a diversion program has 1 year to complete diversion. If the defendant requests an extension beyond 1 year, the current statute requires that the defendant must enter a guilty plea in order to obtain a further extension. I think it's also fair to say, based on Mr. Marquis's representation alone, Mr. Marquis represented that in his county it had about, the DUI diversion program had about a 30 to 40% failure rate. That would be a 60 to 70% success rate. I think in terms of criminal justice program that is a fairly successful rate. I believe that the DUI diversion program does work. When we're talking about people that fail diversion, I think it's also important to keep in mind that there are those people who fail diversion up front, meaning that they fail to show up for treatment or that they drop out of treatment quite quickly. At present, the present diversion statute allows a court to review someone's progress in the diversion program. It allows for a show cause hearing to be set, for an order to show cause to be served on the defendant, and for the defendant to be terminated from the diversion program. I think if the issue is that people are not adequately completing the diversion, then I think the mechanism exists and perhaps they may be strengthened. But I think that the people that are not working out in diversion, a great percentage of them are the people that are not engaging in treatment or failing to appear early on. With respect to people that abscond on criminal cases, that's an issue always in all different sorts of cases. If someone enters diversion and never makes it to the treatment, and a warrant is issued and the warrant is out and it takes a year to find the defendant and charge him, that's no different than what often happens in numerous types of criminal cases where there's no requirement of a guilty plea. So the failure to appear is a cost for the state. It's harder for them to present their cases, but that's a consideration that applies across the board to all criminal cases.
Susan, thank you. Any questions? Senator Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one. Susan, I'm confused about one comment you made. It doesn't make sense to me, and I'm just not tracking it. You say defendants who are not guilty will no longer be eligible for diversion. I don't understand that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, Senate Bill 302 would require the defendant to enter a guilty plea, to plead guilty, that I am guilty because on such and such a date I drove under the influence of intoxicants. It does not make provision for someone who is not guilty. I mean to say is that they cannot, in their opinion, they are not guilty. Maybe their defense attorney also believes that they are not guilty in the circumstances, meaning that they were not driving under the influence of intoxicants. They may have been charged. Their case is pending.
Hang on, Susan. I've been in court before. Mm-hmm. Don't judges ask the defendant if they're making a decision of their own free will? Don't they ask them if they've considered all of the circumstances and the outcomes and consequences?
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. The court.
Okay, so I don't understand where you're going here.
Well, perhaps I'm not explaining this clearly. In order for a court to accept a guilty plea, most judges require that there be the defendant admit that they have engaged in conduct that made them guilty.
Right.
What I'm saying is
voluntarily.
Freely and voluntarily.
Correct.
If you have a defendant that says, I consumed two beers, but I was absolutely not under the influence of intoxicants.
Then go to trial.
Correct. At present, somebody who is in that situation who says, I consumed two beers, I was not legally under the influence of intoxicants to be guilty of DUII, but I would nevertheless like to participate in the diversion program because I can't afford to go to trial, I don't want to take the risk, or I simply have an alcohol problem and may not have been under the influence on this occasion, but I want treatment.
Right.
Those kind of people would become ineligible.
So I spent 3.5 years doing traffic enforcement, DUI arrest, and almost everyone that I stopped said they had two beers.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I'm sure that it is an overly exaggerated statement on behalf of many defendants, but I also believe that there are defendants that are arrested for DUII and are not guilty. We need to only look at the success rates at trial. There are people that go to trial.
Mr. Chair,
But in that case, if they successfully complete diversion, they wouldn't have the guilty plea on their record.
That's my point.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess what I'm not being clear is by requiring a guilty plea, those people could be ineligible because the judge would not accept a guilty plea unless the person is willing to state, I was driving under the influence of intoxicants. So the court could say, I am unwilling to accept your guilty plea because what you're telling me is you're not guilty, and therefore the case must be set for trial. And that person may have reasons, and there may be good considerations why the state would want that kind of maybe marginal case to go into trial.
But, Susan, they're going to have an attorney there who's going to explain the wisdom of their choices, mm-hmm. I assume.
Correct. Mr. Chair, I just don't know why someone being guilty or not guilty of a DUI should be a necessary predicate for someone entering a diversion program.
Because it's a privilege. It's not a right. I mean, it really is an effort on the state's part to try to give someone an opportunity, if they have a substance abuse problem, to get through a program that can facilitate their changing their life behaviors, mm-hmm. so that they don't do that again. And it's not something that's granted to them by the Constitution. It's really an attempt to try to get people who have substance abuse problems into a program.
And, Mr. Chair, I agree that that is a purpose, and it's a good purpose of the program, but I think that also people that may have been consuming alcohol and their behavior did not rise to the fact that they were driving under the influence, that it may be good that they also participate in such a program.
All right, Senator Ringo.
Thank you.
I'm interested in whether this will save money or not. The proponents of the bill say that it will save money because it will avoid chasing people down that flunk out a diversion. You've already got a conviction on the record. And I guess, and then you have a different reason why it will cost more money. Mm-hmm. But just focusing in on the proponent's reason why it will save money, I mean, do you accept that is a reason this will save the state money?
I don't. Coming at it from a different perspective, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I would disagree. My conclusion would be that ultimately it will save the state money. There are a number of considerations, and I think the forecast here. I think if we're using Mr. Marquis's numbers, he's talking about 60 to 70% successfully completing diversion. So we're talking 30 to 40% of those cases. What percentage of those cases go to trial? I don't know that.
Wait a second. When somebody fails diversion, there will be no trial because you've already got a guilty plea. Isn't that right?
Correct. Mr. Senator, I was saying now, in terms of what the costs are now, when I'm trying to consider what the costs are now and what the costs will be then, I think you have to balance on the one hand that 30 to 40% fail rate would no under the Senate Bill 302 would no longer be able to go to trial because they would have entered a guilty plea.
Right.
And you have to compare that against the number of people that may choose not to enter diversion if a guilty plea is required that may go to trial.
Exactly.
Then you also have to take into consideration across the board is the increased amount of money that will be used to appoint attorneys and to what extent
That's why my first question is, did you accept that at least for the 30 or 40% there's a savings on that end? Even though on your argument there's going to be an offsetting increase somewhere else. Right?
Correct. Mr. Okay. Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't know what percentage of that. There will be some saving. To what extent, I do not believe that of those 30 to 40% of those cases that fail diversion, that 100% are going to trial. A lot of these will be people that are in warrant status and abscond. So they may actually be entering a guilty plea at the end. It may be a very small percentage of those cases, of the 30 to 40% that fail, that actually go to trial.
Well, certainly resources would be spent chasing them down.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rayo, resources will still be used to chase them down if they're in a warrant status. If they are they've entered a guilty plea and they're in diversion and they fail, and there's a show cause hearing, a warrant's issued for their failure to appear, there will still be that same amount of cost.
All right. I think you've agreed that at least on that end there's going to be some savings. It's hard to know how much.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there will be some savings
okay,
in terms of trials avoided.
On the other end, you're going to argue that there will be additional expense. And I'd like to know how this committee is supposed to know what the net is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I believe Ms. Christian has reviewed this matter in the past. There's been some changes since her review in terms of there's been an increase in the appointment of counsel for DUI diversion programs in some counties, and that in speaking with her, I believe that she intends to...
She's next on the list.
Oh, she's testifying. Okay, then.
Well, I'll wait and ask the question for them. Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, one final matter. That's on the question of appointment. I think there is also this issue which the court, which the committee will not have a definitive answer, which is going to be the increase in trials and the cost of the increase in both court costs and the costs of counsel for those kind of cases.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Share your comments.
Okay.
And it's now your turn.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian. I'm employed by the Judicial Department as the Director of Indigent Defense Services. I also serve as the Judicial Department's criminal bill analyst for purposes of identifying issues specific to court operations or judges. In the latter role, I'll first make the comment with regard to make the following comment. The Judicial Department takes no position with respect to this bill. With regard to the discretion of the court to allow a finding of good cause for an extension past the 30 days to file the diversion petition, what I would indicate is judges generally do like to retain their discretion to make findings of good cause. And I'm not familiar with any other area of the law where a district attorney is placed in the decision of effectively making a good cause decision. So I raise that just as something that I'm certain the judges would be concerned about. And since I've heard, even before the hearing and talking with Mr. Marquis, and the other prosecutors who have testified before you, what appears to be the major issue with this question of who will have the discretion to make that good cause finding is that in one county and maybe more, but I frankly had not heard of an instance where the courts were allowing motions to suppress evidence to be heard prior to an individual submitting a petition to enter diversion. And I might suggest that issue be dealt with as a condition of diversion. My memory of when, and I do have a memory of when the diversion law was originally passed, is that the intent was to really do away with the right to speedy trial, because the defendant has to waive that to go into diversion, to do away with other certain rights, constitutional rights, and I see the defense attorneys may object, but I see a solution to this issue with regard to who has the discretion to decide whether or not there's good cause to simply bar an individual from filing motions to suppress and taking the court's time and taking the prosecutor's time. So that's all I'll say with regard to that issue. With regard to the judges likely would, as a group, oppose any lessening of their discretion. And also I think there's a more practical solution to deal with the one or few, I truly believe, counties where this is an issue. I'm switching hats now to indigent defense. And with regard to indigent defense costs, I can tell you that in 1995, there was a bill that was introduced that would have required defendants to enter an agreement to stipulate to the facts, not plead guilty, but simply to say, I will agree with those facts, Mr. Chair, for example, when you were in the DUI detail in Multnomah County, if I were charged, I would be required to go before the court and say, I stipulate to the facts as they are set forth in Officer Minnis's report in order to get into diversion. So that was a bill that was introduced in 1995, and I was faced with the situation of having to submit to Legislative Fiscal Office a fiscal impact statement on that bill. And at that point in time, we knew that the Court of Appeals had ruled that there is no right to court-appointed counsel for the purpose of deciding whether or not a person will go into a diversion program. And that was because there is no guilty plea required. And I'm really truncating, it may be hard to believe, but I'm truncating my testimony because I have had the opportunity this morning to talk with Mr. Marquis in particular, and I do believe that we may be, I believe we are requesting of the chair a bit of additional time to put together a global fiscal impact statement that includes indigent defense costs. That
actually, I think that would be wise.
We need to, definitely. And I'm not in the position, obviously. I can do the courts. I can do indigent defense. But I welcome, as we did on Senate Bill 133 last session, early disposition programs to really assist legislative fiscal to get the entire fiscal impact statement. Because in 95, and I certainly don't want a repeat of this, is for indigent defense in the courts, we put in a fiscal impact, and it was $1.3 million, based upon the fact that there is no right to court-appointed counsel for that decision. And since then, I can tell you, many courts, Multnomah County included, have been appointing counsel on people who are eligible for diversion. They didn't do that up until about 9 months ago. Deschutes County was considering it. I checked this morning. They have not yet done that. And I think many courts have decided as a policy matter, as opposed to a fiscal matter, that it's good for the defendant, it's good for the court, it's good for the prosecution to have an attorney at the very beginning of the case. So there has been a change.
So in saying that, you're suggesting that the fiscal may be smaller than what the
correct
fiscal was. Okay.
I
don't know. I want to kind of move on a little bit, because what I was going to do is, and let me lay this direction out to you. And the whole of the committee, I think I agree with the points made with respect to retaining the power of the judge to have the good cause provision. And I also agree with the idea that perhaps you wouldn't make the entrance into diversion allowable if there were motions filed, or you wouldn't allow the motions, whatever we have to do to make that happen. Is that something the committee tends to agree with?
Okay.
But I think I sense that agreement here, and I think the big question will be the one that Senator Ringo raised, and that is there a savings here? If it's revenue neutral, then it just becomes a pure policy question. So, you know, we want to do this. But I think the committee does have an interest in trying to find ways of streamlining and, you know, saving some resources if we can, but we're also interested in preserving justice, I think, too, in terms of
Mr. Chair, if I have two quick things.
Sure.
We will be meeting to work on a global fiscal. Two things. Since 1995, it was 1997 where the DUII diversion law was amended to require a guilty plea if a person is asking for an extension to complete treatment greater than a year. So that already has had a fiscal impact on indigent defense, and I just need time to figure that out.
Sure.
Also, the issue of the second and final thing is, when I first looked at Senate Bill 302 and I saw the repayment of court-appointed attorney fees, it dawned on me that maybe the proponent's intent was to provide for those funds, to the extent people can repay, to go back into the indigent defense account to replenish the fund. And that is not the case unless there's an amendment to the bill.
And I would agree that that's a good amendment, again, for the committee, I think. My sense is the committee would agree with that.
Thank you. The final thing is 1997, again, it must have been a busy year, but in 1997, at my request, the legislature did allow for recovery of court-appointed attorney fees in any kind of case. Doesn't matter whether there's criminal.
Now, 1997 hasn't faded out of your memory. Do you remember who was on the committee in 97?
Don't ask
Senator
me that.
Senator Courtney, this is one of his big
Mr.
deals.
Mr. Chair, yes, it was. Absolutely.
One of his issues.
It was.
He's probably listening.
Since
he can't be on the committee,
he listens. He wants to come into the committee just to participate a little bit because he misses it so much.
This would be a good bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I have one question before you leave. Ms. Christian, you talked about in 1995 a bill requiring defendants to stipulate facts. Did that bill not pass?
It did not pass.
Okay. And then the second ancillary question is, stipulating to facts is different than a guilty plea, is it not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, absolutely. Okay. Stipulating to facts, as a quick example, is what's required in Multnomah County for their drug diversion, their drug court.
So we could do that in this bill?
Absolutely.
You could, but I think the issue there, you subsequently do have another judicial proceeding.
You very well could, Mr. Chair. Stipulating to the facts would allow a person who is unsuccessful to then be able to file a motion to suppress. That's the big difference.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 302. We'll move to Senate Bill 301, public hearing. Kamala Sugar again. Did I pronounce it wrong? No? Both? Everybody, come on up, with except of Susan. You're on the other side.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 301 would create a new crime of unlawful imprisonment. When I read this bill, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I struck me that it's a similar crime to kidnapping, but with some differences. In kidnapping, the prosecution would have to show that the person who was kidnapped was taken from place to place or was secretly confined in a place where the person would not likely to be found. In this new crime, there would just have to be a showing of confinement of the person without their consent. It would be a Class C felony, which and a grade 5, which I think also would make it a lesser crime than kidnapping.
All right. Who's going to go first?
I think I am your...
Have at it.
Again, I'm Gina Skinner from the Oregon District Attorney's Association, Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. This is actually a bill that we had, I think, originally introduced in the last session, and at that time I had done quite a bit of research of other states. There are quite a few states that have bills that they don't exactly mirror this language, but are very similar in the idea of trying to confine this criminal activity a little bit easier than what's currently under the law in kidnapping. This is a situation that happens not super frequently, but frequently enough in domestic violence cases, which I primarily prosecute, where a victim, is basically almost held hostage by their partner in their home. They are, by force or threat of force or violence, are kept, whether it's just in a room or kept in their home, and they're basically just not allowed to leave. I prosecuted a case now, it's probably at least 3 years ago, where a woman and her husband were in the middle of a divorce, and he sort of cons her into coming over to the house to sign some paperwork. She comes into the house to sign some paperwork, and then he has a gun and then basically takes her into the back bedroom and holds her at gunpoint. He's kind of unstable, I think, at this point, as far as just emotionally because of the situation, saying he's going to kill her, then he wasn't going to kill her, then he wanted her to, you know, do this and do that. She basically just stood there, and luckily one of her children had come with her and was in the other room. He had shut the door, and she yelled to a child to call 911, and they did, and the police came, and the SWAT team came, and they surrounded the house. And it's like you're looking at this case, and at no time did he require her to move from one place to another. He just held her there. At no time was she secretly confined, because there's the entire SWAT team standing outside their house. It was very clear where she was. So as long as it's in your own home, I think it would be impossible to prove that the person was secretly confined. And so this would be basically a way in those kind of cases that we can make it criminal to the level 5 on the criminal guidelines, which would be a presumptive probationary sentence unless the person had a much more elevated criminal history. In order to go to an actual Oregon State prison and not serve your time in a local jail, you would have to be in either an A or B on the sentencing guidelines, which would be the highest levels of guidelines, unless one of the aggravators, which are on the bottom, that the person had a gun at the time or that actually caused them physical injury during the crime. But many, many times the person hasn't actually done enough to rise to the level of causing physical injury to the other person. We could charge them with an assault if that's the case. But by keeping someone for hours or days in a home by force or threat of force or any other manner, it is just as equally degrading and violent to a victim. And this would be a tool that we could use in those situations. We feel it would be extremely helpful in basically holding them accountable and requiring them to do whatever treatment that we think would help prevent something like this in the future, or a situation where it's going to escalate into violence or extreme violence.
All right. Questions? Senator Burdick?
Well, when I first looked over this bill very superficially, I could imagine all the writs of habeas corpus coming out of the prisons, and then I saw that there was an exemption for legal authority if someone is in prison with legal authority. But then that also raised the issue of occasionally there are people who are incarcerated or jailed, more likely jailed, and it's later found that there was not cause to put them in jail. And I think the remedy now is to just let them go. But if this were in, could you have possibly be giving somebody a legal case in cases of false arrest?
Chairman, as Senator Burdick, I think that where we have the legal authority at the time that it occurred, that would fall under the whatever the probable cause was for the officer that was originally acting, that would satisfy what would be required for the legal authority. It would also ultimately require a district attorney then to turn around and prosecute, whatever the police officer or corrections officer, I guess, or the head of the prison that was doing that, and that's probably not real likely when we're looking at the crime that was meant to prevent someone doing this unlawfully and then doing it without any legal authority. I think that if that is, in fact, the only issue that this committee has with this bill, we would be more than willing to write up some language that could more narrowly define that to exclude that situation, because obviously that's not anything remotely near what we're anticipating, and I think that's something that could easily be satisfied.
Yeah. Although, actually, I would see most of those issues becoming civil torts, probably in federal court. But I think the language as it stands right now would be appropriate, because any law enforcement officer who takes someone from one place to another, restrict their movements without legal authority, without probable cause, is on thin ice anyway. And there have been cases in the past, including a California Highway Patrol officer who actually took someone under the auspices that they were arresting them, took them out of the desert, raped them, and then subsequently murdered them. This would be an additional charge, obviously not going to help in this circumstance. But yeah, I mean, from time to time, law enforcement officers do things that you wouldn't want them or expect them to do, and would rise to the level of criminal conduct. And I think you'd want to prosecute.
And Mr. Chairman, I had a follow-up as well. It says talks about a person imprisoning another person, but there's the unruly teenager issue. What constitutes a person and what constitutes imprisonment? For example, if you confine a teenager to their room and say, if you come out of here, I'm going to commit bodily harm. And I'm just kidding. Kind of.
That's a good question.
She's a teenager now. Yeah,
I'm a teenager. I'm sorry.
Very good question.
Bear with me here. What is the legal authority? What relationship does that have to parental decision making? At what point does a child have rights under this if they feel that they've been unreasonably imprisoned?
Chairman, as Senator Burdick, Kamala Sugar, also from the ODAA and from Lane County District Attorney's Office, and I'll answer that because I actually spent some time talking about this with a local police officer in our county who had some questions about this bill. 161205, ORS 161205, has a specific justification for behavior by a parent or guardian with respect to a child. And that is an absolute defense to this bill, this crime. If the parent, or I can just read you a portion of that. The use of physical force on another person that would otherwise constitute an offense, and physical force could include the restraining of someone, is justifiable and not criminal under the following circumstances: a parent, guardian, or other person entrusted with the care and supervision of a minor or an incompetent person may use reasonable force upon such minor when and to the extent the person reasonably believes is necessary to maintain discipline or promote the welfare of the minor or incompetent person. So I think that addresses that issue almost directly.
And that applies to anyone 18?
Yeah, a minor or an incompetent person. So I think they have a definition for that in here too, which I don't have at my fingertips.
Thank you. Because I assume the verbal you know, verbal, it doesn't have to be physical restraint. It could be verbal restraint, making someone feel intimidated or whatever.
Well, I don't think that would rise to the level of confining. But the defense you're talking about, restraint.
Well, but then now I've kind of moved on as to what would constitute confinement. I mean, you know, okay, you have somebody with a gun, that's pretty obvious. But if someone says, you know, if you come out of that room, I'm going to, you know, knock you down or throw you down the stairs or something. I mean, would that be covered by this?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, I think that what we're looking at here is that to confine would be to not allow somebody, basically would not allow someone the freedom to be able to leave that area if that's what they wanted to do. And I think that it would have to be a factual basis as far as what would be seem to be common sense as far as what really would limit someone from being able to physically leave a room, whether that's physical force or the, you know, an actual and reasonable, you know, imminent threat of physical force at that time.
It's a pretty severe penalty if someone issues a verbal threat to somebody and that has standing with the person. You know, the person takes the threat seriously, but you haven't. Maybe another person would not see that as a viable threat. This is a pretty severe penalty for that type of situation.
And I think that basically you've got also, if you look into the kidnapping statute, which is 163.225 and 235, there is the subsection that requires in both of those statutes that either the person is taken from one place to another or that a person is secretly confined. And so that word confined is defined in case law as far as how much someone would have to do to actually confine the person. So I think that would be, that's already narrowly defined as how it's applied to the kidnapping statute. And I think that we wanted to have the act be the same as kidnapping to confine the person, the difference being that, one, it didn't have to be secret, so it could be in your home, and that you wouldn't have to prove they couldn't be found there. But other than that, that is already in case law. And if you look at the penalties for that statute, just for the kidnapping in the second degree, or that's all we would have to prove, that's about Measure 11 offense with 70 months of prison. And so here, this would give options for prosecutors to be able to prove or to charge somebody where they don't think that's necessarily the right penalty, but they want to hold the person criminally accountable to get them into some kind of treatment or into some amount of incarceration, that this would fit perfectly with a lot of the scenarios as well, and the sentence would be much less, which ultimately would save money.
Uh-huh. And, Mr. Chairman, I think it would be helpful to get some of this case law made available to the committee if you'd be willing to do that. Thank you.
If I might, I wanted to address a couple of the other questions that were asked. Chair Minnis and members of the committee. I don't know what we had submitted an amendment or a proposed amendment. I don't know whether it made it. I know it was submitted to Bill Taylor a couple of weeks ago, and it basically added the language with the intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty, which is the language from the kidnapping statute. And some questions had been raised about the time frame. I think Senator Burdick was touching on that, and there have been some questions about. And we thought that additional language, it makes it a true lesser included of kidnapping, because otherwise the statute is exactly the same, except that it doesn't have those requiring secret confinement or requiring what we call aspartation, moving someone from one place to another. But saying the language with the intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty, it really does limit what circumstances you might charge this crime in. And I'd like to echo a couple of things. One is that not only is this really kind of like an in-between for a case that might otherwise be either charged as a kidnapping because there's nothing else to charge or left in this kind of gray area, and so therefore allowing a lesser punishment for a more appropriate type of result, It also, there's a crime out there that we, as district attorneys, have been using in domestic violence cases, and that's the coercion statute. And that's right there in the same section, which is 163.275. And again, that statute is extremely cumbersome. It basically puts it at a level 7 on the guidelines, again, this being a lesser spot. And it would be basically the same cases that are being charged as these more serious crimes, the opportunity to charge them as perhaps a lesser crime when the enhancement things don't apply. You can see in coercion, if you're looking at the statute, that it requires placing or instilling in another person a fear that if they don't do what you're telling them or making them do, you're going to do something to hurt them or damage their property. So it becomes, in this case, it's a cleaner way to charge the case that Gina talked about, which is, for lack of a better example, a man holding a woman hostage in the bedroom. And we see this a lot. And or they take them, say they do take them from one place to another, but it's just from the bedroom to the kitchen to get a knife, you know, or something like that. We're really not taking someone a great distance. And we want to charge a crime that's really more a false imprisonment. The last thing I wanted to touch on was that I did speak with a law enforcement officer in Lane County about the concern regarding law enforcement officers being charged. And as pointed out, it would really much more likely be a civil case that a former defendant brings against an agency. And that statute already exists. There's already a civil false imprisonment statute. It's highly unlikely that a police officer would be charged just because a person is acquitted of a crime for false imprisonment. It would require some other things. And with the phrase without consent or legal authority encompasses the concept of probable cause, which every police officer needs to have in order to make that arrest. So
I really wasn't talking about the case of acquittals. I was talking about the instance of false arrest where it's later found that there was no cause to arrest someone.
If Senator Burdick, if there is a situation where the officer acts without legal authority, then that person may end up being reviewed for criminal behavior. But that's unusual, and we don't want officers acting without legal authority. So, I mean, I'm not saying that we intend to use it that way, but I mean, of course, if an officer were way beyond, as Chairman has suggested in his example from California, if an officer were way beyond the scope of their appropriate duty, just as if an officer did anything else that was...
No, and I have no problem with that either. It's just that this is being presented as more of a domestic type of situation, or friend to friend domestic type situation, not all together, but it would have this other impact, and I think we need to know that.
Well,
at the front end,
Senator Burdick, and I would say then that all of the criminal statutes have that same impact. I mean, kidnapping doesn't have any exemption for officers, and if an officer is arresting someone, they are taking them to jail, and so they're taking them from one place to another. So I don't think this.
See, actually, years ago in the Portland Police Bureau, it was rumored that some officers were taking certain undesirable individuals in their district and transporting them to St. Helens, dropping them off, and they were subsequently told that's not a good idea.
So the chairman, were any of
them charged?
I think there was a threat that they'd be charged if they didn't knock it off. So yeah. That was the rumor, anyway. Senator Ringo.
Usually a baseness of facts in those rumors, Mr. Chair. Also, I kind of wonder if we don't pass a budget by September, whether we're going to be confined in this building. Raise this here. Ms. Conrad, I'd appreciate knowing the example that you gave. Guy held his wife, SWAT team arrives, gun in. What charges were available? What tools did you have at your disposal for prosecuting that guy?
I think the only thing that we were able to charge him with was coercion with a firearm, because in that case coercion's a C felony, and so we were able to put the aggravating firearm language on that case. And again, that she was not allowed to do something that she had the right to do, basically with the fear that he was going to cause her physical injury.
So that came to what category offense?
That's a 7.
And so you were disappointed because it wasn't a 5.
Not necessarily. I can tell you that the coercion statute, as it's currently written, first of all, is seven
is lower.
Higher.
Okay.
7 is higher.
Okay.
So there'd be more, depending on the criminal history.
That was more severe. That was more severe than what this would allow you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, I think one of the practical problems that I've seen now that I've been in two different counties, I can compare them, is that the coercion statute is extremely cumbersome and difficult to understand. And quite frankly, there are some offices that shy away from really ever using that statute at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think people are very nervous about charging people with that crime for a lot of different reasons. In the past, my understanding, there's been some case law that's been unfavorable. My understanding is that was all fixed, but I think that just sort of the practice of using it isn't real common, and that I think it's relatively recent that we've even been using the statute at all for domestic violence.
What is a Category 5 offense? What's that sentence?
Category 5 offense, I had Mr. Prinz provide me a copy of his guidelines, and basically it would say that based on someone's criminal history, that they would be presumptive probation unless they had 4 or more adult non-persons felonies. If they had between 4 or more non-persons felonies, prior convictions, up through having 1 person's felony, then they would be presumptively doing jail time but not prison time. They wouldn't even be looking at doing prison time unless they had 2 or more person's felony convictions on the record prior to committing this crime, which is not that common to have someone with that much of a criminal record. And so I think that if you're looking at the financial aspect of this, if this is passed and is very clear and it's easy for prosecutors to plug in the same facts that we're sort of using in these other kind of statutes, where the person has been looking at most likely going to prison on a coercion charge and definitely going to prison on a kidnap 1 or a kidnap 2, here we would be probably looking at a cost savings because people would be charged with this instead under situations where they think it's appropriate. Now, the situation where I described where there was a gun, it would be this bill would then require it to be a level 6, which would be the same as felony assault 4, for example, is also a level 6, where usually about half of the people, it's right in the middle, kind of fall into probation, about half would be looking at going to prison.
I guess I'm somewhat troubled by the fact that there's no time requirement. I mean, if you lock somebody in a closet for 10 seconds, that's a violation, right?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, if I could, that's why we had written that amendment that said with the intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty.
Well, that substantially interferes for a short time.
Well, I think you'd have to get a judge to agree with you on that, and that would be pretty tough. I think if you look at case law, and we can probably, we were asked to provide some case law already on the issue of confinement. We could also provide case law on the issue of what it means to interfere substantially, because that is already done in the kidnapping statute, and I know that's been litigated. So I think
the kidnap uses the word substantially.
The language with the intent to interfere substantially with another person's liberty is directly out of the kidnapping statute. And so it's already been litigated and defined by the courts. I think that's why I had put that in there, as my hope was that it would address the issue of how long.
Because Senator Ringo, currently under the law, if you do that, this phrase that Ms. Sugar just described to you, plus you either take a person from one place to another or you secretly confine them, that is a kidnap too, and that's a presumptive 70 months in prison currently in Oregon. And there's just this big gap in between almost nothing going to that, and we just see enough of these circumstances where there's this hole of somebody being terrorized in their own home and not allowed to leave, whether it's one room, a closet, or the home generally, that we would like to be able to have something that's less that we can do for that situation.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Looks like we need a little bit of work on this, Bill. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Susan? Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in opposition of Senate Bill 301. In our opinion, Senate Bill 301 is an overly broad and unnecessary expansion of the law. I would agree with the DA's representation that Senate Bill 301 would be an easier vehicle for the district attorney to use in prosecutions, and that's because it encompasses a huge variety of conduct. Senate Bill 301 encompasses mere verbal behavior. There is no requirement that the defendant actually do any physical act, have any physical contact with the purported victim. There's no requirement that the defendant threaten force or physical injury or damage to property. There's no requirement that the victim fear physical injury or damage to his or her property. There's no requirement that there be a weapon or a threat of a weapon. Senate Bill 301 would felonize many misdemeanor domestic violence cases and, in my opinion, would criminalize a large category of currently non-criminal verbal arguments. The following examples would fall within the scope. You're not leaving this room until we finish this conversation. Stay put. I'm trying to talk to you. Senate Bill 301 would also cover non-domestic situations. In addition, I think, to when we're talking about police officers acting beyond lawful authority, I believe that Senate Bill 301 would also cover a situation where a retailer stops and detains a suspected shoplifter. It should be shoplifter, not shopkeeper, on less than probable cause. The retailer is confining the person without legal authority and without the person's consent. Senate Bill 301, I do believe, may cover parental discipline. A parental child discipline exception currently exists under Oregon law, and I think that's been cited, but it's limited to reasonable physical force, and it does not address or exempt verbal confinement, which is what Senate Bill 301 criminalizes.
Well, hang on. Before you get going too far, if the substantially interfered language is put in, does that resolve the issue?
No. Mr. Chair, that, I believe, is not a time frame issue. I don't believe that a kidnap is not a kidnap because somebody kidnaps someone for a short period of time. It's a question of a person's liberty and substantially interfering with a liberty.
So you have suggestions for what language you would add to eliminate the verbal issues? Because I don't think it's intended to deal just with verbal or bring verbal or.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, my position is that we already have all those crimes. The things that I would propose adding are already crimes. I think that the fact that the case that the district attorney has used as an example as to why we have this need is actually a more serious charge, where in addition to being a Class C felony that's a level 7 versus level 5, was also with a firearm minimum, which would have required a 5-year mandatory prison sentence for the gun minimum. So I don't have language that would fix because I don't think there's any need for it. I think when you think of an example, there are crimes out there.
Let me give you an example from a case that I investigated. And it's a rape case. It was ultimately successfully prosecuted as a rape and found via video and DNA and all that kind of stuff. It's a long case. But the facts of the case are that this woman goes out on a date with a guy that she thinks is a nice guy. And late in the morning, they end up at a park. Argate Park in Northeast Portland, and they walk out into the bushes and they're doing a little kissy face because they're getting to know each other and stuff. And she says, "I've got to leave. I've got to go take care of my baby." In fact, the friend who's there with her, waiting in the car, comes out and says, "We've got to go. You've got to go pick up your child." She says, "It'll be just a minute." And she's attempting to leave. And at this point, this particular individual throws her to the ground, and she's resisting violently enough that she's screaming. Then the neighbors are calling the police. Now, this person successfully ultimately raped her, mm-hmm. but in my example, if this woman was able to escape, what would you charge her with or charge him with? How would you prove an intent to rape if he never successfully raped her? He just merely held her to the ground.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe that's a coercion.
That's a coercion.
A coercion is, and it's really broad language, and I disagree that it's cumbersome. It's used. Mm-hmm. It was drafted, and it was used. The crime of coercion, I think, addresses the problem here because it really is what they're talking about. It's what the district attorney charged in that case, and mm-hmm. I didn't hear whether they had a conviction. I mean, I didn't hear that they didn't. The crime of conversion is committed whenever a defendant compels or induces another to engage in or abstain from conduct which the other person has a legal right to do, and the defendant does so by instilling in the other person to fear that the act will cause physical injury, proper damage, or engage in criminal conduct. Mm-hmm. So that woman, in your example, had a right to leave.
But what's the criminal conduct? I guess I'm eliminating the rape portion and just the being held for a period of time against her will. It's not a kidnapping. You're not being taken from one place to another.
And Mr. Chair, it doesn't require that there actually is criminal conduct, simply that the defendant does so by instilling in the other person a fear that the actor will cause physical injury. So you don't need to cause physical injury. It's simply if you fear by either, it could be your tone, it could be words that you use. In that example, I mean, there's also physical injury. So I think that is a clear coercion, a more serious crime than what the district attorney is proposing here. So, and I don't think there are proof problems with that. It's very clear.
All right. Good example.
In terms of the other kind of context, I would disagree that with some of these things, I mean, I'm not aware of the case and all the fact specifics, but I would disagree with any characterization that there's a requirement in a kidnap that there has to be a certain amount of movement. So I know that cases are prosecuted. We're talking about moving someone from a room to a room in a domestic violence case, that those cases are prosecuted and have been successfully prosecuted as kidnaps. And secretly confined. I would also disagree with any characterization that someone's home is not sufficient to constitute a place where somebody can be secretly confined. There are loads of other cases. When a person intentionally attempts to place another in fear of serious physical injury by word or by conduct, that's the crime of menacing, which is a Class A misdemeanor. If physical injury occurs, there are a series of levels of assaults. So I believe that Senate Bill 301 criminalizes just a vast array of behavior where we already have all the vehicles before us. If Senate Bill 301 were passed, I also believe that we would have a concern as to disproportionate punishment. Because when a defendant would cause physical injury or place another in fear of physical injury, this would be a misdemeanor, Class A misdemeanor, where punishable only by a year in jail, where the in opposition to Senate Bill 301, where a defendant confines the person merely by telling the person not to leave, this would become a felony. So if you actually injured someone, assaulted them, or threatened them in circumstances that caused them fear of serious physical injury, that would be a misdemeanor. But neither of those things present, it would be a felony, a Class C felony. I mean, this Senate Bill 301, it could include a huge array of conduct.
I appreciate what you're saying, but, you know, as a sexual assault detective and a legislator, it grieves me that the vast majority of victims in these cases are women who are, in, for the most part, without power to resist the behaviors of men, oftentimes men who have been in their lives for years and the relationship has gone mm-hmm. sour. And if, in my opinion, as a legislator, I would want to give prosecutors every possible tool in the law or criminal statutory construct that gives them an avenue to prosecute someone who really tries to exercise control over another individual who doesn't want to be controlled, mm-hmm. who they have no right to control. And it really kind of grieves me that you're resisting this kind of a transition or change when the victims are so often vulnerable individuals.
And, Mr. Chair, I think that's exactly why we have coercion, and that's why coercion
but
works.
But coercion isn't, don't you think it's somewhat cumbersome?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't think it's cumbersome. And I'm not sure.
Let me make this argument. Don't you think the legislature ought to say what it really means in statute?
Say
it clearly?
Mr. Chair, I think that coercion says it very clearly. The reason why it's broad is it's trying to encompass all different types of behavior.
You know, we didn't used to prosecute domestic violence cases very often.
Uh-huh.
When I started as a police officer, you didn't. The police officer had discretion. You go to the host, you say, hey, knock it off. Quit hitting your wife. And you leave because the wife doesn't want to prosecute. Mandatory arrest comes along. Now we're prosecuting these cases because I think our culture has recognized the seriousness of these events. Likewise, we're prosecuting child sexual abuse cases. like we've never prosecuted them before, because our culture has recognized the seriousness of the vulnerability of these victims. So I guess I have to disagree with you. From my perspective, I want to give prosecutors every possible tool in terms of statutory construct that allows them to argue in court that this person has no right to exercise control over somebody, to beat them, to have to force sexual activity on them, or to restrain their freedom or their liberty.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rico.
I mean, just for purpose of discussion,
sure.
You can't give them every possible construct, because then you're going to set up a negotiating structure that's unfair. I mean, you know, if they had the possibility of death penalty for this kind of stuff, people would be pleading to 10 years in jail. And I just think you can't give them every tool. You have to there's a reasonableness.
Right. Thank you for showing how dramatically.
Well, that's okay.
But actually, there are some advocates that probably would advocate the death penalty.
And sometimes they probably deserve it.
Yeah.
But
this is kind of spinning out of control.
Mr. Chair, I would be presenting a different position with some proposed amendment if what I heard was testimony that there are a whole category of cases, which I think was the kind of testimony that came out in favor of the original coercion bill, is that there were all these kinds of cases in domestic case where one party was preventing another from doing something by implying threats, and that really wasn't adequately covered because there may not have been an injury that actually occurred. There was simply the threat, and that's why we have coercion. And what I've really heard is the district attorney said is that there, by making it basically sort of a straightforward, encompassing all varieties of non-criminal and currently criminal behavior, it would be simpler to present when they had a higher offense. So they would have had a level 5 if this was the bill. They had a level 7, which carried a 5-year gun minimum. So I think that they had we're talking about one example where they actually had. So I just don't think, you know, given the concern that we all have to prevent domestic violence and to have punishment and to have investigations and prosecutions, I don't think what's being presented to you is really a case where it's not working.
I've been in the business too long, because sometimes I just wish that the victims had an opportunity to take a brick and beat them over the head. But you don't find it. In fact, I can bring in a confession that I took from a guy not too long ago who took a woman at the estate hotel and drug her downstairs into the basement and managed to break her ankle and rape her. And I'll tell you something, you listen to the tape and you listen to what he says, and if there's so much rage in my spirit that comes up just listening to it, it's hard sometimes to want to not fix the law so that it's constructed in a way that we really are being plain and clear about what we're trying to prevent in terms of conduct. I agree with Senator Brink. I'm getting a little bit wild here, but would you be willing to help put together a statute that is clear and tries to deal with these issues, or to construct the coercion statute or some other statute that tries to address this issue?
And Mr. Chair, I'd be more than happy to look at that. And I think that I guess my only concern in saying that, and I don't mean to belittle these concerns, is that I actually disagree with that the coercion is a cumbersome statute. I think it's very clear. I have defended cases, and I have seen numerous cases where it's prosecuted successfully, and I believe that really the conduct that the district attorney is describing that they wanted to get at when they have a concern that they may not be able to make the kidnapping standard is really a coercion. So I'm not saying I wouldn't be willing to. I certainly would be. But I think that what you're going to be adding in is this, by instilling in another a fear or, that the actor was going to cause physical injury or do something. It can't
right.
just. So
okay.
I'm
well,
more
I
than happy to do that. But
great.
But my concern is that we may get back to where we already are.
Well, we may, but we may say it more clearly.
Okay.
And I think that might be helpful.
And
Senator Ringer.
Sorry, Mr. Testimony. Could you comment on how this parallels the substantially interfere language of the kidnapping statute?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, by adding that, it's my opinion that what we're talking about is whether someone's liberty is substantially interfered with, not that it's not a time frame. So, for example, if somebody is kidnapped at gunpoint, there's no requirement that they be held for a specific amount of time.
Are there cases, are kidnap case laws, where somebody's been held to substantially interfered with somebody's liberty where they're moved for one block or for a very small length of time or a very small distance?
And I believe, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, and I can look at this, but my understanding and recollection of the law is that any movement constitutes a kidnap. So moving someone from one place or the other within a home is often charged as a kidnap and is prosecuted successfully. So there's no requirement that there be a substantial.
So we could amend the kidnap statute.
Yeah. I mean, I was just going to ask Mr. Perkins what your thoughts were on the
kidnap requires substantial interference. Does that require a significant length of time or moving for a significant distance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I could answer that, but I think what the better thing to do is I'll get you a memo and look at the cases, because I think it's, as everything, we've had kidnapped for hundreds of years, and it's going to be worthwhile to give you the full breakdown of it.
I mean, Mr. Chair, my concern is the interference that it is, the lock in the closet for 3 minutes, or you've confined somebody for a short period of time, and violence is really not involved. And it just seems to me that, not condoning that, but it's a different thing than kidnap.
Well, Senator Ringo, not to really argue, but I just don't know who has the right.
Well, they don't have the right.
Closet for 3 minutes and feel like they get a King's X and
no, they don't
not
have
the privilege, you know, not have to face the consequences.
No, they don't have the right, and I don't condone it at all. I guess I look for some proportionality.
Well,
that's what I'm seeking.
Okay, I understand that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, in those kind of situations where, and I think the district attorney had even said that in some ways passage of Senate Bill 301 could benefit a defendant rather than charging with a kidnap to where they may be technically guilty even though their behavior was lesser than some other, there are a number of alternatives such as, for example, charging them with attempted kidnap, which would be a reduced charge.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the domestic situation, and to me that seems to overwhelm us. I mean, I could see college pranks. I could see lots of things going on that...
Okay.
It makes me nervous.
Sounds to me like this thing needs a little bit of work. Susan, you've committed yourself to helping. I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the only final thing is that I think that perhaps if what I'm really hearing is that there is a coercion statute which really addresses this, but it's cumbersome, that maybe the best way is to look at amending the coercion statute at the same time as this new bill.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, your job as a defense attorney is to defend your defendant based on the facts, circumstances of the case, right?
Correct.
Because you guys don't manufacture any defenses, right?
Correct.
That would be a violation of bar rules.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill, whatever it is, 301. Now, we've got just a short period of time for the last bill, 299. Senate Bill 299. We'll do a quick public hearing on that and kind of open the door. Yes, we've got, first up is Tom Mann, is that right? Marion County. And you're neutral.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tom Mann, living in Marion County. I'm a communications electronics specialist. I work for a state agency, but I'm here as a citizen on this issue. I support the idea of what this bill is trying to get at, which is people driving while watching television. I've seen a lot of, in 30 years in electronics, I've seen a lot of things happen in technology, and they used to be really big, and now they're really small. The problem I see is that the language of this bill is very much identical to ORS 815240, which prohibits television display. My understanding from conferring with some of the supporters this morning was that the problem with the language in that statute is that it specifically addresses broadcast television and omits various compact recording devices. The problem that I have with the particular wording here is that it refers to the viewing on a display screen of an electronic device, entertainment or other material that doesn't aid in the safe operation or navigation. I'm involved in doing radio survey work from time to time. In fact, I'm considering setting up a small consulting firm to do this line of work. I set up electronic equipment in the front seat of a car. I push a button on it and then drive the car around and it records data. This bill would prohibit that line of work. It's not that I'm watching.
How does it prohibit that line of work?
Well, because the definition they're using here is viewing an electronic device, And that's a very wide open, you know, you're looking at the display of an electronic device, and that's fairly wide open statement. You know, quite honestly, looking at my pager is viewing an electronic device not related to the navigation of a car. I can remember UPS drivers coming in with a clipboard that you would sign, and now they come in with an electronic pad. And if that pad is sitting there where he's driving, which is showing him where his next stop is, that's, it's not a navigational device, but it's an electronic device within his view. Whereas, you know, I've spent enough time driving motorcycles to drive up beside people and see what they're doing in cars. I remember pulling up alongside of the principal of a high school in the Gresham area who happened to also be on the church board where I was, and she's reading a report while she's driving her car down 181st. And at stoplight, I kind of tapped on her window and said, you know better than that. And she said, yes, I do, and put it all away. To me, the key issue to get at is drivers driving and not paying attention to their driving, being distracted. So I've suggested some alternate language here of driving while distracted, of doing, performing any or attempting any activity that diverts one's attention from safe operation of a vehicle, considering the existing circumstance. In other words, if it's a bright sunny day and there's no traffic, if you're talking on your cell phone, that would probably be all right. Whereas if you're talking about driving down the road in an ice storm, you better have both hands on the wheel and, you know, be paying very close attention to what you're doing. I certainly agree that viewing entertainment television while driving would be prima facie evidence of being distracted. And I think, you know, one might even want to add another clause to be able to go after a passenger who does something, you know, pulling a prank. Pour a glass of cold water on the driver of a car is going to distract them from what they're, you know, that safe operation. I wouldn't fault the driver of the car, but I certainly would fault the passenger, especially if it resulted in an accident. I think there's some... The overall concept here is really good. I think there's some ways to make the language a little more concise, because just the term electronic display covers so many things in our present world.
Senator Ringo?
Well, driving while distracted, I couldn't have my kids in the car, that's for sure.
How about driving while annoyed?
Well, the research that I've stumbled across related to, you know, talking about cell phones, they've come to the conclusion that it's not the action of holding the phone, it's the action of becoming heavily involved in the,
right.
You know, if I call and say, hi, how are you doing, it's one thing, but if we start arguing about, you know, a traveling domestic dispute, I remember I used to work for Multnomah County when I thought the moving suspects was the other side of the Sandy River. But
that was for the east side.
Yes, that was the east side cars.
The downtown cars went to St. Helens.
Our council, Mr. Prince, has showed us 815.240 and points out that it does reference broadcast, television broadcast. Seems to me that the fix is to just change it so it could be any television screen, whether it's broadcast or taped or some electronically saved.
All right.
Yes, I believe that would solve the problem, is just bring that language up to current technology.
Mr. Mann, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I'm going to bring up Jim Podwanis. And anyone else, Jim, you want to bring up? Okay, Sergeant Curtis. And Al, are you going to testify with them too? Or?
I can.
Sure. Hey, Jim, go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this. Certainly the purpose of this bill, and number one, I guess we should say that troopers asked us to sponsor this bill, and Senator Walker helped us make it become a reality. So the troopers were seeing an increasing problem with this particular issue, and I think we had maybe had thought initially that the fix would be an 815-240, because 815-240 currently restricts watching a broadcast signal on a television set. And it would make logical sense that you would just say you can't watch it. It's not just a broadcast, it's anything from an electronic device. I suppose at the same time we need to be a little cautious about how far you go with that, because a lot of cars these days have navigational systems in them, which are an LCD display, and their intent is to create a safe operation of the vehicle and get them from one point to another in a safe manner. So our prime objective here is to keep folks from watching a television movie or whatever the case may be, basically like watching the TV, but they plug the little DVD in and they're sitting there watching a movie as they're going down the road. And I can give you an example of that happening just very recently. I was coming back from Medford the other day, and while I admit I was driving a little faster than the speed limit, this lady comes bebopping by me quite a bit faster than I was going, and she was holding something in her left hand while she's driving down the road. And as she's going by me, she gets really close to my vehicle, and I'm thinking maybe I need to move, so I moved because I thought she was going to hit me. And she goes ahead, and she's going over the center line, and then she goes over and hits the rumble, strips on the left-hand side, and she's back over again. And I'm like, what is going on? And so I speed up. She's going almost 85 miles an hour, holding a small DVD player, watching what looked like a movie to me, holding it in her left hand, wandering all over the road. It just doesn't seem appropriate to me that we take our home entertainment video systems and think now that we should move those into our passenger vehicles and turn our cars into our home, basically. It's a huge responsibility to drive a several thousand pound deadly weapon, basically, down the road, and you need to keep your attention directed to operating that motor vehicle and not doing other things in the vehicle.
Senator Burdick, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So what did you do? Did you rest her?
I was in my private car, so... And there was right where that happened to be, there was no cell service. So I backed. I wasn't going to keep driving 85 miles an hour, and she just kept going down the road, going all over the place.
What can you do in a case like that?
Well, in this particular case, I think probably because of the speed she was driving and the way she was driving, I suppose one could have taken her license number and tried to get her stopped and maybe given her a citation for reckless driving, quite frankly, at the speed she was driving. Although I never saw a single state trooper from Medford all the way back to Salem, so I don't think that would have helped either.
That's another issue.
All right.
Thank you.
We hope to get that in the next couple of days.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, my name is Kirk Curtis, and I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police Patrol Division. I come here in basic support of this bill, but I do have some concerns with regards to the way the language of the bill is written. The way it is written, an electronic display screen could be your digital radio, any type of device that gives you any type of digital screen that you look at. And the way the bill is written on lines 8, 9, and 10, it says for entertainment purposes, so a person looks over, adjusts their radio, and they're getting the radio voice back or audio back, technically that will put them in violation of this law. One suggestion that we would have is to basically take that same basic language, and the suggestion would be is to change it to say, and who views on a display screen and of an electronic device in the vehicle materials that aid the, basically that it's a visual, so that they're a visual entertainment purposes. Put visual entertainment purposes in there rather than just for entertainment purposes. So that would be the DVD players or the televisions, this type of thing, and it would still allow the people in the motorhomes that currently have the backup monitors to aid them in the backing the vehicle safely. It wouldn't affect them, and it wouldn't affect the people that look at their digital watch or their any other digital display that's put out in the motor vehicle. So it would be a visual entertainment. And so the person that's going down the road playing Pong on their cell phone or this type of thing, and the officer recognizes that there's a game on there, they could stop and pick them up. Or the person that's watching the DVD player that's mounted on the visor or in their hand, they could stop and pick them up. But if they had something in there that was aiding them either in their operation of a business or things that we take for granted at this time, such as our watches, looking at our pager, maybe a cell phone use, this type of thing, it wouldn't encumber them. The other section that we would like to see is on the last part of the bill. It basically says that it doesn't apply to police, fire, ambulance, or emergency vehicles. And we would like to have you just basically cut out the rest of the language after emergency vehicle. because it says, and who views the display screen of an electronic device in the vehicle material that aids the person in performing emergency activities? Well, we view a digital display screen on our moving radars when we're going down the road. We're not actively engaged in any type of emergency situation at that time, but it's a tool that we use to help us in our regular duties and enforcement activities. So if you basically cut it there with regards to the emergency vehicles, it will allow the operators of emergency vehicles to use the equipment that we currently have. And believe me, our bosses will not allow us to put televisions in the vehicle to watch or DVD players to watch movies as we're doing our job. But basically, this would allow us to use the tools that we have to have an electronic display or a viewing screen and to be able to use those tools in the performance of our jobs in statute.
Right. You could just delete the word emergency and include official activities, something like that. It's workable. Okay. Al, what do you got to say to us?
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the car rental folks and tow truck operators and, through the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I have the same concerns that the other two gentlemen talked about, line 8, electronic device. Tow truck operators live and breathe by their cell phones for directions, and we need to have those, and many of them do have display screens. We also have in our rental cars and in our tow trucks what they call global positioning systems, which do have screens on them that we use, tow trucks for maps of the cities, and wherever we are working, and same with the rental cars, also rent cars with those. We would want to make sure that we are allowed to continue using both. That concludes my testimony. I do agree with OSP's visual entertainment purposes amendment. I think that tightens it up for us. So.
But it seems to me some of the new GPS systems that are in newer cars, I've been told you cannot enter any data into it unless the vehicle stopped. That's not true? Okay, but again, that's not true.
Chair, members of the committee, the ones that I have visually had a chance to watch in operation, there's a warning sign on them, the Toyotas. There's a warning sign that says this shouldn't be operated while the vehicle's in motion. But once you activate the device, it does show you locations and moves and shows you on a mapping device where you're at as your vehicle moves.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
But I'm getting a signal that you can apparently enter data into your things.
Mr. Chair, I've looked at just recently some new vehicles for myself that had GPS systems in them, and once you start moving, you don't have the ability to go in and reprogram it. Well, it displays and continues displaying. They didn't have the ability to sit there and watch that and punch new information into the system until you stop the vehicle.
Okay. I got this gentleman behind us who's got a smile on his face. I bet may not be 100% sure in some cases. One of the other issues I want to just raise before we close this is I think we're really trying to focus on the activity where a vehicle is moving or in motion. Because if someone's actually stopped and parked, their engine's running, is that operating motor vehicle? I would think that probably is to a degree. If you come to it, so if you're sitting in the front seat of your car watching a digital movie on your DVD recorder, but you're actually stopped and you have the engine on because you want to keep the heat on or keep your engine, battery from dying, technically you might be in violation.
Mr. Chairman and members, as I recall, as a young DA trying to prove those cases, there are some cases that say things like that would be operating, that are not moving, they're not driving, but I wasn't very successful in winning those cases. But I think that you're right. There is some language around that operating may include a non-moving vehicle.
But I think what we're really trying to get to is to make sure that the driver maintains control of the vehicle.
Right.
It's not
That's correct.
Distracted.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. Anyone else wishing to testify? Senate Bill 299. No one else wishing to testify in the business before this subcommittee will be committee. There's not. We're